Hello everyone and welcome to Bargaret Moffat, episode 15, Gambler. 1483 wasn't exactly a great year for Henry Tudor, any more than it was for his mum. He traipsed mournfully across Normandy and into Brittany to the fair town of Vannes, where the first bit of news that he heard was that Buckingham had been executed. Sic transit gloria mundi, buckers, he might have remarked miserably to himself, chewing on life's gristle. But when he managed to whistle, his perspective began to change, because various very important rebels began to arrive in town, presumably mud splattered from all the frantic riding and covered in bark from all the hiding in trees. John Morton and Elizabeth Woodville's son, the Marquis of Dorset, to name but two of the most important. Meanwhile, Duke Francis continued in his Mr. Helpful Positive persona and agreed when Henry asked him to pledge aid should he try to claim his throne encore une fois, gov. At Christmas, he and his merry band of brothers swore an oath together, and Henry swore that if he became king, he would marry Elizabeth of York, an offer designed to keep on side all the rebels of Henry IV's old household who had survived the 1483 uprising. Elizabeth of York was not consulted. Of Margaret in the next 2 years, we know very little indeed again. But there are straws blowing in the wind, along with all those answers Bob was looking for. One is that it is highly likely she was writing to her lad. None of the letters survive. But it seems that Stanley, fulfilling his dual role as jailer and husband, allowed her a good deal of latitude without doing so much that he would arouse the king's ire. And a ballad suggests that Elizabeth Woodville, in her heart, remained on Team Henry, whatever her public behaviour, and added her words to those of Margaret to try and bring Stanley around to Henry's side. Now Richard was well aware of the dangers, and his actions confirm the increasing desperation of his fears. The contemporary Polydore Virgil, historian if you are Team Tudor, Tudor apologist if you are a Ricardian, wrote that Richard was vexed, wrestled, and tormented in mind with fear almost perpetually. Also, he suffered a horrible blow, the death of his and Anne's only son, Edward. The couple were at Nottingham when they heard, and became almost out of their minds for a long time when faced with such sudden grief, as you would. Within a year, Richard would also lose his wife. At the time, the various Tudor historians talked of rumours that Richard had poisoned her so that he could marry again. There is no proof of such thing. You can make your own choice. I'm choosing not to believe it, and to feel sorry for Richard and Anne's loss, which must have been awful. Richard, however, was not the kind of guy to sit around chewing his lip, waiting for things to happen. He was a man of action. What his regime needed was legitimacy and stability. His first step was to persuade Elizabeth to come out of Westminster Abbey and join him at court. For Elizabeth, the equation was that she could not stay in sanctuary indefinitely, and she owed it to her daughters to normalise their lives. So, after Richard swore a public oath to do her no harm, she rejoined court. And by the sound of things, to her daughter Elizabeth of York's great enjoyment in the Christmas of 1484. Still, the real problem was out of Richard's reach in Brittany and apparently in high favour with the Duke. So Richard shows us now his regnal chops, if I can put it that way. He needed to find a way to change Francis's attitude. He needed to find leverage. Now, part of that leverage came from France, where Anne of Beaujeu was regent for her young son and began to put pressure on Francis, eager to make sure Brittany became French. And meanwhile, Richard chose this very time to respond to Breton piracy, which is something of a constant in the medieval world. He let his very own pirates off the leash, commissioning them to visit fire and sword on Breton shipping and ports. And it worked. by the latter part of 1484, Brittany was suffering badly, and Francis wanted it to end, please. At the same time, though, Richard offered the hand of friendship. Oh, sorry about those Cornish. I do try to stop their old tricks. But how are you doing with France? You must be worried about them. By playing on these fears and providing 3,000 English archers to help, Richard both pressurised Francis and showed him the advantages of alliance. Set against that, how valuable really was his support for Henry, who had already tried and failed to seize his throne, the loser. So Henry came as close to disaster in 1484 as he had ever been. Francis, and maybe more specifically his chancellor, Landois, actually agreed in secret to Richard to hand Henry over. Enter Christopher Urswick, envoy of Margaret. Somehow Margaret came to know of these wicked, wicked plans, and you have to guess that the news came from Stanley, further evidence that the Stanley rat was leaving the sinking Yorkist ship. Urswick came to Brittany, met with John Morton, and thence to Henry. He was in direct danger now. He must fly for France. Fly, you fool. Together, Henry and the ever-faithful Jasper made their plans to escape. Urswick, firstly, was sent on a clandestine mission to France to gain permission to enter France, which was quickly given. In the late summer, Jasper Tudor left the Breton town of Vannes, apparently on his way to meet with Duke Francis. Presumably, he was whistling casually as he went. But when he came near the French border, he legged it as hard as he could over the border into Anjou in France. 2 days later, Henry Tudor left Vannes with just 5 servants, saying that he was going to meet a friend. Presumably, he was also whistling casually. And when he neared the border, guess what? He too lifted his skirts, showed his hairy knees, and legged it over the border. Too late, the Bretons realised what was going on. They sent men in hot pursuit, but Henry was over the border just an hour before they caught up, daring do or what. By October 1484, Henry was safely ensconced in the French court, and negotiations began. At this point, Duke Francis appeared to wash his hands of the whole affair and let the rest of Henry's supporters leave and go to Paris too, on the grounds that they were eating him out of house and home. Richard must have been apoplectic with rage. So close, so unlucky. By 1485 then, Richard knew full well that he could expect an invasion from Henry, and his power to prevent it was slight. All he could do was prepare. And in fact, he probably now welcomed the coming challenge. Only by defeating Henry in battle could his legitimacy be won. On the 7th of December 1484, he issued a proclamation denouncing Henry and his invaders. Henry, meanwhile, was flooding England and Wales with letters seeking support. At the top of the list would have been 2 of Richard's most powerful magnates, Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland, and, of course, the Stanley brothers, Thomas and William. Henry had already received a boost when John de Vere, Earl of Oxford, left Ham Castle near Calais to come and join him, to be duly rewarded with the position of commander for the expedition. Meanwhile, the French were accommodating, without being wildly so, but loaning him money and allowing him to recruit. And right at the end of July 1485, Jasper and Henry were ready to go with their intrepid band. Or motley crew might be a better description of some French soldiers, English exiles, Norman villains scraped from the prisons. And so on the 7th of August 1485, Henry and his band of probably 4,000 warriors and cutthroats landed near Milford Haven on the coast of Wales. Henry jumped into the surf when they arrived and did the traditional ground kissing for the cameras. After he'd wiped the sand from his lips, which you never really get rid of, do you, if my experience of beach holidays is anything to go by. The obvious route was then along the south of Wales, straight towards the prize, London. But instead, Henry took a much harder route, north along the west coast of Wales. You might ask why, and presumably it was because Richard had loyal supporters in South Wales, and until he could increase the size of his army, Henry would have wanted to avoid conflict. Richard, meanwhile, probably found out that the moment of truth had arrived around 11th of August 1485. Letters and commands were sent to Percy, Norfolk and Stanley in particular, as well as to his own men, to assemble at Nottingham in the English Midlands. Henry arrived at his first major town, Shrewsbury. Into history steps the valiant and true bailiff of the town, one Thomas Mitton. Bravely, Mitton lowered the portcullis, and he refused entrance to the rebel Henry, declaring grandly with a great oath that they would have to walk over his belly before he allowed them in. Sadly for Mitton, the citizens of Shrewsbury didn't like the sound of this, and they took Mitton off to one side and burnt his ears for him. And before you could say abject and humiliating surrender, Henry and his army were marching gaily through Shrewsbury. Thomas Mitton, meanwhile, lay down in the muddy street, belly to the air, so that Henry could indeed step over his belly as he had vowed. Mitton's honour was thus duly preserved, though not his dignity. By the 21st of August, Henry was at Atherstone in the Midlands of England, stepping on the old Roman road of Watling Street, which said southeast towards London, and was just 20 miles from Leicester, City of Dreams. And it was at Leicester that Richard had assembled his forces on the 21st of August. As far as he could see, Richard had scored 2 out of 3. Both Howard and Percy had arrived for him. Richard had on paper a pretty decent army then, and pretty good odds. At least 7,000 men to Henry's probably 5,000, and quite possibly Richard had even more. Now, obviously the Stanleys were proving a bit of a problem. They were still floating around the area, not showing any obvious signs of which way they were planning to jump. But as he set out to meet Henry in battle, Richard would have been pretty comfortable. Certainly, there were no signs of any large-scale desertion, and by the evening of the 21st, the two armies were ready for battle the following day. But on the morning of the 22nd of August, poor old Richard looked like death warmed up, plagued apparently by terrible dreams and demons. But what is clear is that Richard wanted this battle, and indeed he needed this battle every bit as much as did Henry Tudor. Meanwhile, as Howard, Duke of Norfolk, came out of his tent in the cold light of dawn, he found a friendly note waiting for him. "Jack of Norfolk, be not too bold, for Dickon thy master is bought and sold." Howard, however, was to prove every bit as resolute as was Richard. So Richard arranged his army in battles, with Howard commanding the vanguard. The position of Percy is quite interesting, but he and his contingent appears to have been left out on the left in some way. Richard must have been constantly plagued by doubts. Would Percy remain loyal when they arrived at Le Crunch? Of the Stanleys, Richard appears to have made up his mind, in fact. Famously, he has supposed to have demanded Stanley declare himself and threatened to kill his son, who he held, Lord Strange. And he received from Stanley the reply that Stanley had other sons, so do your worst. Richard did indeed apparently order the worst, ordering his men to behead Lord Strange, but the order wasn't carried out. As it happens, the Stanleys were still playing both ends at this very late stage. Henry's urgent inquiries got no more satisfaction than did Richard's. The Stanleys were playing for time. Henry's army of exiles, Welsh, French, Scots, came on, skirting round the marsh to attack Howard in one mass battle. They were peppered by Richard's artillery and handgunners. Any notion that Richard was poorly prepared should be ignored. Plenty of ammunition of both types had been found on the battlefield. But then Richard gave the command, and Howard charged down the rise into Oxford vanguard, and the vicious business of hand-to-hand fighting began, pike and billhook, sword and axe and dagger. It seems as though Oxford ordered his men into tight groups around standards, and in the press, this concentration of people seemed to work, and they began to gain the advantage. Either that, or it was just bad luck that Howard was killed. And anyway, that in itself can't have helped morale for the Yorkists. So the fight was hard, but for some reason, Richard was unable to deploy Percy's battle, and Percy's battle contained most of Richard's northerners, his most committed supporters. Now this might be for two reasons. One, it could be that the marsh now prevented Percy from joining, blocking him, so that the only way for him to join the battle would have been to actually go through Howard's battle. Or it could be treachery. It could be that Henry's letters and blandishments had done their work. At this point, Henry put himself in great danger. He and his small personal guard became exposed. Either he had simply become disconnected from the main army as Oxford pushed forward, or maybe even he had decided to ride to William Stanley to entreat him to join and swing the battle in his favour. On his hill then, Richard and his cavalry saw an opportunity. If he could charge and kill Henry now, the battle would without doubt end in triumph. If he killed Henry, the judgment of God could not be clearer. Plus, it could be that the main battle was going against him. Certainly, his most trustworthy supporter was dead, Percy's loyalty uncertain. But, by attacking Henry directly, he would expose himself to horrible danger, disconnected from the rest of his men, and right in front of the Stanley's position. If their loyalty did indeed not hold, he would be in horrendous danger. He stood on the edge of a cliff. Danger and opportunity fighting for supremacy in his mind. And as he'd done in 1483, Richard rolled the dice. "This day I will die as a king or win," he roared, and kicked his horse into action, and with the men around him ordered the charge, the gold circlet on his crown gleaming as he rode. Richard led his cavalry and slammed into the exposed Henry with vicious speed and weight of horse metal. They hit and carried all before them. Richard's path to Henry was blocked by a massive knight, John Cheney, but Richard hacked him down, chewing through Henry's guard. William Brandon was cut down, and Henry's standard fell, and to all who saw it, that must have signalled the end of Henry Tudor. But the charge was slowing, its impetus going, and Henry's men resolutely gathered around him and desperately resisted. At this point, William Stanley rolled the dice and ordered his men to charge. And the object of the charge was not Henry, but Richard. It seems likely that at this point, as the Stanleys flew towards Richard, that he did have the opportunity to run, to escape back to his army. Though with the Stanleys now committed, it was Richard that was outnumbered. But Richard was committed now. If he could just reach Henry, all could be saved. But Stanley's men hit before he could break through, and now the tables were turned. Richard's horse was killed from under him. At some point, he must have lost his helmet, and he was hit by several glancing blows that cut his scalp and took chips of bone off his skull. In agony, he fought on, but a mounted man struck down with a dagger and pierced his skull. And then came a mighty blow from a heavy-bladed weapon, which opened his skull at the base of his head, and night closed on his eyes, and he bit the dust. Whatever his crimes or triumphs, one thing nobody could take away from Richard was the heroic nature of his death. To give the last words to that arch-assassin of his reputation, Polydore Virgil, he died fighting manfully in the thickest press of his enemies. Margaret, of course, was not there, and was forced throughout Henry's march and battle to wait for news, though maybe letters went to and fro as Henry marched through Wales. Obviously, we can be reasonably sure of Margaret's joy and no doubt vast relief when the news arrived. Henry was to give her a gift, a book of hours that he took from the dead king's tent and signed by Richard. Margaret had already noted in her own book of hours, "This day King Henry VII won the field where was slain King Richard III. Which I have to say, that's a rather emotionless entry. When she received Richard's signed Book of Hours, she permitted herself a little more latitude, erasing the name of the hated usurper who had seized the crown of her Lancastrian ancestors. And in this book she wrote, "For the honour of God and St. Edmund, pray for Margaret Richmond." All the worry, the hoping, the scheming were over. Next week, everyone, we start a new project on the British Constitution and Common Law. This came high on the voting on Facebook. But there was a significant proportion, well, one, who said, "What on earth are people voting for this for?" So, do not despair. We'll keep going with Margaret. I have a number on the English and their drink for you at some point. And, of course, we will restart the history of Scotland. So, if it's not your cup of tea, a bit of patience, we'll see you right. Also, don't forget it's the omnibus for this week if you prefer a longer episode so that you can, you know, nod off more easily. Meanwhile, thank you so much for being members, everyone. It's really lovely of you. I am eternally grateful. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.